So it's my pleasure to introduce our first speaker, who's going to introduce the program. That's Rabbi Fraim Mervis, who's the chief rabbi of the Commonwealth, and he inherited that post in September 2013. He was born in South Africa, received rabbinic ordination in Israel, and became the chief rabbi of Ireland, actually, in 1984, which is a post he held for 8 years. He then moved to London, England, where he started the Kinloss Learning Center, also known as Finchley, a successful community education program which served as a model for other Jewish communities, as well as the Morasha Jewish Primary School. He's a great advocate of interfaith dialogue, and he was the president of the Irish Council of Christians and Jews from 1985 to 1992, and he's taken part in many such interfaith dialogues with church leaders, Muslim leaders, and so on, and in fact was the first rabbi from the United Synagogue to welcome an imam in his shul and facilitated a gathering between the members of his shul and those of the Finchley Mosque. Those of you who have heard him speak in various forums know that he is a powerful and compelling advocate for Judaism. Please welcome Rabbi Fraim Mervis.
Shavua Tov, everyone, and what a great pleasure it is for Valerie and me to be here this evening. But please do excuse us because we're on a whirlwind visit, and immediately after my address, I will need to go on to my next speaking engagement. And it's just so fortunate that I happen to be here at the time when your conference is being staged, and I was delighted to reply affirmatively to the invitation extended to me to come here very briefly and to share some thoughts with you. And you'll have to wait for the panel to respond to specifics, because I'm not going to be speaking about specifics. Rather, I'd like to give a broad view of where I see modern orthodoxy today. And in many respects, I will echo the views of the Rav, Rav Strachler, who just spoke before me, with whom I agree wholeheartedly. When Yaakov Avinu was just about to pass away, he summoned his grandchildren, Ephraim and Menashe, to receive a bracha. And through them, he gave a bracha for all Jewish communities and people throughout all ages. And his words were, V'yidgu larov bekerev haaretz. May you multiply like fish in the midst of the earth. Yaakov Avinu was saying that if we are from generation to generation to find the capacity to successfully maintain our continuity in this world, we will need to take on the character of fish. And this evening, I would like to present to you my own original thought on the matter. It developed at a time when I was in Ireland, and part of my responsibilities as chief rabbi with the world of kashrut, and at that time from Ireland we were exporting a lot of kosher fish, particularly kosher smoked salmon. So I got to be a little bit of a mumche in the world of salmon. And in that way I started to understand what Yaakov Avinu must have meant when he said, V'yidgu larov, may you multiply like fish. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the world of farmed fish, and more specifically farmed salmon. It's a fascinating world. You see, the fishermen go out every day to the very large nets which have been lowered in the calm waters of a bay. They are kept up by buoys. The fish are introduced at the stage of infancy into the nets. They are fed every day. The nets are checked every day. And eventually, when the fish are large enough, they are yanked out of the water and they are prepared for us to grace our tables. Now, there is a major plus of the system of farmed fishing. The plus is that you've got the fish in their natural habitat. They're in the waters of the sea. They're doing what fish usually do. And also, you can protect them from the larger fish, which might easily have come through and gobbled them up. But there is a downside, And that is that the fish are held captive within those nets. And they aren't free to swim the open waters of the sea. Then there's a second type of smoked salmon product that one can buy. It's of the wild variety. It's more expensive. It tastes better. We get the wild salmon from the fishermen who go out in their boats into the open waters of the sea. They drop their nets and they catch those fish. And because those fish are free in those open waters to swim many hundreds of miles, the texture of their flesh is of a greater quality, tastes better, and it's more expensive. There is a major plus for the open wild fish because it can go wherever it wants to. There are no walls, no borders, no boundaries. It can swim many hundreds, if not thousands of miles. But there is a downside, and that is that at any possible moment, a larger fish can come along and unexpectedly swallow it up. Now, I'd like to suggest that there are two types of Orthodox Jews in the world today. There are those of the farmed variety and those of the wild variety. And there are pluses and minuses to both styles, to both hashkafot of Yahadut. With regard to the farmed variety, they are actually the strongest within our Jewish world today. They are protected. Jewish people who are raised within walls, they are cared for, they are looked after. From the earliest possible years, they are protected. They're breathing the same air as everybody else. They're within the natural habitat of society here on earth. However, the rules and regulations that apply, the restrictions that are put in place mean that they are saved and protected from the world out there which might easily devour their Judaism. And so it is quite possible that in the same way as the nets can be broken now and then and large fish can pierce through and come into the farm salmon area, so too there is a process of what's being called chazara b'she'ela, through which some of the most committed Jews are unfortunately losing their emunah. That, however, is the exception. The rule is that they are strong in their commitment. They maintain their belief in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and in the course of time, they introduce new generations to follow in their footsteps. They're the fastest growing, largest part of the Jewish world today. And then there is a different variety of the wild type. No borders, no restrictions. We're here in the open seas of the world. To embrace modernity, to benefit from what society has to provide for us. There's a major plus and a major minus. The plus is that we are in a position to bring the beauty of our tradition to touch all of society, to cause a great Kiddush Hashem through all of mankind being able to appreciate what the Jewish world has to offer. And isn't that what the Navi meant when he said that we should be an Or LaGoyim, a light unto the nations, and you can only be such if you are in the midst of the nations and not on an offshore island cut off from them? But there is a big minus, because at any moment, out in those open seas, we can be unprotected to the extent that our guard may drop and we can lose our commitment to our Yiddishkeit. And indeed, we can see how today there is such an enormous challenge out there with regard to the farmed variety. It's thrilling, it's exciting, it's wonderful, it's challenging. When we succeed, the Kiddush Hashem is enormous. But when we fail, chas v'shalom, emuna can be lost. And indeed, we are seeing today, at a practical level, that there are far too many young men and women who go through our entire school system, who might even spend a year or two in Israel, studying in a yeshiva or in a sem, going to university and on campus, losing their commitment towards Torah and mitzvot. What did Yaakov Avinu say? He said, V'yitzgu larov bekerev ha'aretz. We need to multiply like fish bekerev ha'aretz in the midst of the world. Yaakov Avinu was advocating surely to us that the highest level of commitment through which we can get the highest level of satisfaction is in the midst of society, following the ways of the wild fish variety. You know, when Moshe Rabbeinu sent the Meraglim into Eretz Yisrael, he gave a list of questions to them, one of which was, Haba machanim im b'miftzarim, find out if those living in the land are in open cities or in fortresses. And our mefarshim differ. Some of our mefarshim tell us that if the Meraglim would come back and they would say that the Canaanite cities are walled, that would be a sign of great strength. Other mefarshim come back and tell us that if they would return and say that the Canaanite cities are walled, that's a sign of weakness, because it means that the inhabitants need the walls to protect them. They're not strong enough to protect themselves. And indeed, it is the case that when we are taking on the mantle of the wild Orthodox variety, we have an enormous responsibility. Surely it's the derech, the path towards the highest possible level of fulfillment and achievement. However, it's a high-risk, high-dividend policy. So therefore, what we need to consider, I believe, is the life of Yosef HaTzadik. Because he is the archetypal, biblical, wild, committed Jew. Yosef HaTzadik, who grew up in the house of his family, imbued with the learning that he received from his father, and then emerged through circumstances beyond his control to be not only a part of Egyptian society, but to become a leading member, indeed, the leader of that society and of the known world at the time. And what do we find? When Yosef is confronted with temptation, Diokno shel Aviv, he sees an image of his father. The reason why he didn't fall to the temptation of Eshet Potiphar was not because he wasn't in the mood, but rather because he said to her, V'chatati le'lokim, I can't do this, because if I would, I would be sinning against God. The chinuch that he had received prepared him for those moments when he was out there in the wild waters of the world around him. And notice that he is the only one who in our Talmudic tradition has the title Hatzadik, the righteous one. Yes, you have Noach, Ish Tzadik, etc., written in Chumash. But the only person about whom Chazal said he's a tzadik was Yosef HaTzadik. Yaakov, who was Yoshev O'alim, he's not referred to as Yaakov HaTzadik. Yosef, who engaged with the world, who was a man of the world, who brought his Torah to be appreciated by the world, who succeeded in raising a family true to Torah and Mitzvah, to the extent that to this day we bless our children that they should be like Ephraim and Manasseh, who walked in the footsteps of their father to continue that tradition. That's what made him into the tzaddik. Because he preserved his tradition, his authentic Torah way of life, and at the same time he was an outstanding member of society, embracing the modernity all around him. He surely is the great role model for us in our times. And as a result, therefore, we need to decide our derech. And by the way, it's not a clear cut either or. For all of us, we need to decide where we're drawing lines. In some respects, we might take on some aspects of the farmed Orthodox style of life to give added protection to us and to our families. And in other respects, we might draw lines elsewhere. But in the event that we are taking on that derech of the wild fish variety, let us do so lachatchila. Let us do so with enthusiasm. Let us know that our way of life is the real way. It's authentic Torah. It's what enables us ultimately to be a tzaddik or a tzaddeket. Let's not feel that it's only bedi'evet, that true frumkeit belongs in other areas. Adarabba, on the contrary, we have with us the ultimately true Torah tradition. Let's embrace it. Let's guarantee, like Yosef HaTzadik, that we will preserve our Torah ideology, and at the same time, we will embrace modernity, enjoy the world around us, and bring the beauty of our tradition and the glory of our ways to touch our environment, to sanctify it, through which, Im Yirtzeh Hashem, we will all cause a Kiddush Hashem. May you all be blessed in your deliberations, in the specifics that you will touch on relating to the challenges that we confront within our lives as committed, successful, wild Orthodox Jews. And may Hashem be with you to bless you here in this great city, within this wonderful Jewish community, to continue to hold forth that torch and to bring light not only to Klal Yisrael, but to all the world around us. Thank you very much.
Spontaneous turn here. Let me fill out the question list. Well, not all of it.
Okay.
All right, Adam. We're going to take a little spontaneous turn here.
What are you going to do?
I'm going to ask you if there's only two kinds of fish. Thank you very much. Good evening. I'm Dr. Elliot Malamud, and want to welcome you. Thanks for coming. So on the surface, modern Orthodoxy in North America flourishing, vibrant communities that embrace Judaism, participate fully in the economic and intellectual currents of the contemporary West. But there are growing discussions in its ranks about all sorts of things, gender, sexual identity, questions of spiritual passion versus rote observance. And so it finds itself really at quite a crucial crossroads. So tonight, we've invited three figures in the modern Orthodox world to sit down and think through some of these issues, and I want to introduce them in alphabetical order. Directly to my left, Dr. Adam Furtziger holds the Samson Raphael Hirsch Chair for Research of the Torah with Derek Eretz Movement. He's in the Department of Jewish History and Contemporary Jewry at Bar-Ilan University. He's also the Senior Associate at the Oxford Center for Hebrew and Jewish Studies. Dr. Furtziger is the author or editor of six books, including Exclusion and Hierarchy, Orthodoxy, Non-Observance, and the Emergence of Modern Jewish Identity. It's actually a great book. And most recently, Beyond Sectarianism, The Realignment of American Orthodox Judaism, which was the winner of a 2015 National Jewish Book Award. On my right at the end, Rabbi Haskell Lookstein is the Rabbi Emeritus of Congregation Kilat Yeshurun in Manhattan, where he was the senior rabbi from 1958 until 2016. Rabbi Lookstein served as the principal of the Ramaz School for 40 years until 2006, received his BA from Columbia, his MA from YU, where he also received his smicha. He's part of one of America's legendary rabbinic families. I invite you to see my interview with him tomorrow morning, where we're going to talk about the Lookstein family. He was named by Newsweek magazine as the most influential Orthodox pulpit rabbi in the United States in 2008. And directly to my right, Ms. Shuli Taubes, who received her Master's of Divinity from Harvard Divinity School She teaches Tanakh and Jewish Identity at SIR High School in Riverdale, New York, where she also chairs the Jewish Philosophy Department. She's also developed and teaches a curriculum for educating modern Orthodox high school students in comparative religion. Ms. Taubes is the Sofer Community Scholar at the Young Israel of North Riverdale, where she teaches and also serves in a pastoral role. And this year, she's the Wallerstein Scholar at Sheir Shemaim Synagogue right here in Toronto. Please welcome our speakers. You know, I have a whole list of questions, but I think we're going to get a little spontaneous here since I was so intrigued by the idea that there's only two kinds of Jewish fish that I would like to move into that direction and ask Dr. Furtziger, are there only two kinds of Jewish fish, or is it a little more complicated than that?
Okay. How long do
I... As long as you like.
We'll start out slowly, but first of all, thank you very much. It's my second time. About 10 years ago, I was at a Torah in Motion event, and it's really a pleasure to be here, and I want to thank the Kelmans and Elliot and everybody here. I had a wonderful Shabbat, or Chaim, and really, it's very inspiring. It's very inspiring to come back from here to Eretz Yisrael, where to Medina Yisrael, where I live, engaged the people and the ideas, et cetera, here. Specifically to your question, Elliot, I think you know that you might have seen my notes when Rabbi Mervis said what he said. I wrote, this dichotomy is no longer accurate, if it ever was.
What you really mean is it's fishy.
Or it certainly smells fishy, right. So I think that it's nice, and I think that when we as rabbis do sermons, we like to create these dialectics or dichotomies, and it makes for a very nice framing. But and sometimes they're even true, and even academics do them. I think that what this last book that I wrote sort of tried to argue was that there's a change, and there's much more fluidity, and that frameworks of modern orthodoxy and what some people, my teacher Charles Liebman, called sectarian orthodoxy or Haredi orthodoxy, enclavist orthodoxy, they don't work as well anymore. There are certainly distinctions between groups. There are certainly ways that if one wants to create narratives that separate between groups, maybe the social one being the most dominant, to tell you the truth, that they exist. Nonetheless, I see a lot of liminality. I see a lot of people moving between. I see issues, if Rabbi Strachler mentioned before, Zionism. Zionism is a non-issue in 90% of the Haredi world today. If you talk about feminism, so maybe feminism in a certain ideological way is more part of the discourse of the people who are identified with modern Orthodox communities. Nonetheless, I've written about this, and I see indications I'm going to talk about a little bit tomorrow of a certain type of feminism within the Haredi world as well. And I can go on. So I don't think that these distinctions are not helpful at times, but I think certainly to talk about wild fish and caged fish, it just doesn't work. And to tell you the truth, I know some really wild Haredi fish. And I certainly know in Israel people who I adore, some of them I learned from, let's say, who are affiliated with some of the, let's say, sometimes they call them the Chardal community, or the community that's to national religious community that is very ultra-nationalist, that other than the issue of Zionism really conducts their life exactly like people who one would term Haredi. They may have a big kippah instead of a black hat, but the distinctions on many other issues, or almost every other issue, are minimal. That's a starting point.
Okay, so we've gotten the fish out of the way. Rabbi Lookstein, you're the one who has the most perspective here, I think, historically. I'd like to start with you, and you probably remember there were lots of gloom and doom prognostications about the future of Orthodoxy, certainly in the 40s right up to the mid-century. It was seen as an endangered species. And I'd like you to tell me, and I'd like the rest of our panelists to jump in afterwards, what you think, therefore, Orthodoxy has done right in facilitating its own growth, what you see is its strongest appeal for Jews in the modern world, and then delineate perhaps what you think is the key challenges, issues facing it in the generation going forward in the next 10 years. Better get to it.
Do I have 3/4 of an hour to answer that question? The answer is obviously no, so let me just stenographically approach it. I think the first thing we've done right, we really had nothing to do with at all. It just happened. It was perhaps divine providence. And that is that beginning in 1945, when if somebody looked at Orthodoxy in America, the outlook was absolutely doom and gloom. Conservative Judaism was powerful, and Reform was pretty strong too. But there really wasn't a future for Orthodox Judaism. It was going to disappear, just as Ben-Gurion thought that Orthodox Judaism would disappear after the creation of the state, which is why he allowed yeshiva students not to be drafted. And of course, it didn't turn out that way at all. And one of the reasons, a major reason why it didn't turn out, is the immigration into North America of probably hundreds of thousands, or ultimately it certainly became hundreds of thousands of Eastern European Jews after the end of World War II. And then beginning, I think, in around 1956, after the communist takeover of Hungary, the Hungarian Jews. The Hungarian Jews brought lots of problems. I hope there aren't too many Hungarians here outside of my wife, because I don't want to take responsibility for that, but there really was no such thing as glatt kosher before the Hungarians arrived, and that's just one example among many. This was an influx of very serious Jews and Jews with a very high birth rate. So our demographics changed greatly. And then something happened with modern Orthodoxy, probably about the same time that its roots went back a little bit earlier, with the development of two institutions. One, I think the more important one, was the day school movement, which changed the face of modern Orthodoxy, and for that matter, not so modern Orthodoxy as well. The other is the development of synagogues like this one. And rabbis like that one. I must say, my father, Olav HaShalom, had a lot to do with that. He created a model synagogue. I get a lot of credit for KJ and Ramaz. I really am like Alice in Wonderland, running as fast as I possibly can just to keep up with what my father started. But there's no comparison with the way things were in 1945 when you look at 2016. Synagogues that appeal to what Rabbi Mervis called the wild fish out there, Orthodox fish, and most importantly, the day school movement. I mean, my own shul today is largely populated by the graduates of the day school movement. And I think that's probably true of many, many Orthodox shuls. So the day school movement and synagogues that can appeal to an outward-looking Orthodox Jew. I want to state another thing that people probably wouldn't think about, but it's a very significant development. In 1945, certainly in the modern Orthodox community, very few women went to mikveh. Very few. And the mikvaot were grossly unappealing. On the contrary, turnoffs. I remember one of them on the Upper West Side. There was only one mikveh in the Upper West Side or East Side. Now there are four. Interestingly, we have three on the Upper East Side. People think the Upper West Side is more religious than the Upper East Side. I don't know how much that reaches Toronto. But in fact, we've got three on the Upper East Side and only one on the Upper West Side, with which I'm very intimately connected. It's the real community mikveh. But the mikveh on the Upper West Side was on a block that ultimately was condemned for urban renewal. The last building to go down was the mikveh. When you walked into that mikveh building, the hallway had no light fixture. It had a wire coming down from the ceiling with a bulb attached to it. My wife used to say that it reminded her of the movie Casablanca every time. How many people are old enough to remember the movie Casablanca? Raise your hands. Okay, so you know what it's like. Now you go to a modern Orthodox mikveh, and relatively speaking, it's like a spa. I have to say, the Ashkenazic community learned how to make mikvaot from the Sephardi community. They make mikveh very attractive. And we got the message. So that, I mean, and that's a basic part of an Orthodox life. I got 2 minutes more?
2 minutes.
Okay. And then the Al HaKol, above and beyond or in addition to the day school movement and the synagogue development and mikveh and other institutions as well, we can't forget Rav Soloveitchik, Zecher Tzadik Lebracha, whom we miss desperately today. He was the driving intellectual force behind the development of modern Orthodoxy and safeguarding it with his tremendous campaign in the 50s and 60s on Mechitza. He led that fight, and that was a very, very important battle to preserve Orthodoxy. So I'm going to give a chance to other people to talk.
So I think one of the things that Orthodoxy has done right is that it gives its constituents the ability to lead a meaningful life. What Orthodox Judaism does for us is it gives us layers upon layers of significance to even the smallest actions that we do, and I think all human beings are really looking to lead a meaningful and happy life. And maybe we have some work to do on bringing happiness and joy into our community, but as far as meaning goes, Orthodoxy really provides for us the structures and tools to make meaning out of what we do. Professor David Schatz talked about four areas where modern Orthodoxy is really succeeding. One, it gives us a community, a sense of belonging, and human beings are looking to be part of something meaningful, and we have that. Orthodoxy provides us with role models, with teachers, with clergy, with lay leaders who are dedicated to that community, who are interested in developing relationships and helping you guide and guide you through life. Inspiration. We as a community believe that the world could be better, and we're all looking to lead inspired lives. And finally, as Rabbi Lookstein pointed out, it provides us with intellectual excitement and engagement and creativity, and we've done an amazing job with that. And I guess at this point, I just want to pause and say how honored I am to be sitting on a panel with people I admire, respect, look up to. It's quite humbling that the people who are my teachers, role models, inspiration, are sitting on a panel with me. I kind of can't believe that. So thank you. As far as issues facing Orthodoxy today, I'll just point to three very briefly. The first is leadership. On the one hand, there is a crisis of religious authority brought upon the rabbinate by the rabbinate. The perception of our leaders right now, there's multiple stories in a row about religious leaders violating moral codes, and we know it's not everybody. It's not even close to the majority. But we have to hold ourselves to a higher standard and make sure that the structures are in place to make sure that's happening. Also, we need to make sure that we are producing people who are very learned and committed to halakha, who are also conversant in modern intellectual and cultural discourse. We need people engaging the issues that are being discussed about religion in academia and in the universities today, who are, on the one hand, halachic giants and masters of Torah, and on the other hand, are quite comfortable engaging our young people in this type of thought, and who are producing a real theology of modern Orthodoxy that is both intellectually and emotionally appealing to the elites of our community and to the masses. That's first. Second issue or challenge to modern Orthodoxy today, I think, is materialism. There is, on some level in our community, a valorization of wealth. We educate our kids to think that there are only certain jobs that they should be aspiring towards, and that's quite limiting for us as a community. And I think, finally, one thing that we need to recognize is the assault of technology on our lives and how we kind of just embrace it. I think I remember there's a big Haredi conference on the problems of the internet, and I remember being amongst those that laughed at how such a conference could be held. But working with modern Orthodox teenagers today and seeing the extent of the way technology is shaping their lives and how there appears to be no filters, I think we as a community need to begin thinking seriously about the inundation of technology and the way it is affecting our future. Thank you.
So we've heard some positive accomplishments. In a piece which appeared in 2014 entitled "Can Modern Orthodoxy Survive?", Professor Jack Wertheimer noted that many modern Orthodox leaders manifest a great deal of anxiety about current trends within their communities. I guess part of the concern was demographic, you know, are their members growing? But much of the tension lies in what can be seen as a kind of a battle for the soul of modern Orthodoxy, what it believes in, what's its fundamental vision, what lies ahead, or put a different way, to what extent is modern Orthodoxy in tune with modernity, and in what ways is it serious about Orthodoxy? So I guess I want to ask you all whether you see a kind of chasm or a split now taking place in Orthodoxy between those who would like to see Orthodoxy react faster and more boldly to the challenges and opportunities of the modern world, and those who are more cautious in their approach or further along the spectrum, who see this as a surrender to non-Jewish culture and values. Let me cite a few perspectives on this just to give it a little specificity. Rabbi Asher Lopatin has said the following, quote, "I think there's a danger to the centrist Orthodox who really don't want to address the issues of our times, particularly women's issues. They do address them, but there's an inflexibility. They do not see new things within halakha that address it. They don't really want to come up with halakhic solutions to hot-button issues, even to the aguna issue." And Rabbi Daniel Sperber has said the following, "One should confront the basic issue of deconstructing halakha and reconstructing it in a totally egalitarian fashion. In the Orthodox establishment, any innovation is threatening." So these disputes are manifested in specific issues like the role of women or the place of gay Jews, but they also reflect a larger ideological breach over autonomy versus authority. So beginning with Ms. Taubes, I want each of you to comment on this push in certain sectors of Orthodoxy towards more modernity and the pushback against this, and also if you think this growing divide can be bridged, and how.
Thank you. So first, I just want to say that I think the extremes in these positions are often set up as straw men. I think everyone in the modern Orthodox camp acknowledges that some things need to change and that not everything should change. And it really boils down, I think, on many levels to a question of pacing and process. That said, when we talk about battling for the soul of modern Orthodoxy, we're not at war. I think actually healthy competition is a really good thing for religion. Because it forces ideologies and the leaders that shape them to work hard, to be halachically sound, to be socially attuned. And as long as each group has a critical mass to whom they inspire, they'll continue to teach and to preach and to gain constituents. Diversity, I think, is a good thing. It keeps us on our toes. It keeps us sharp. It combats laziness and apathy. Homogeneity makes us into echo chambers, and I think it prevents creativity, and without critical voices, growth actually becomes impossible. But sometimes we need to split. I don't think we should pave over meaningful differences for the value of unity all the time, because what we might end up with is a watered-down version of the religion that nobody really fully buys into or feels passionately about. We must acknowledge that respect for the halachic process and tradition and being in tune with the contemporary world and ethics is tough. It's really, really hard. And anything that's tough, anything that's really hard, means that we must humbly recognize that people are going to come to different conclusions about how best to do it. And I think it's okay to say, I recognize your sincere religious motivation, but you are totally wrong. That is not completely halachic. That is not completely jiving with contemporary ethics. But you're not a destroyer of faith. And that brings me to my final point. For those of us who really, really deeply love this religion, who love Judaism, so much so that we're able to live every day with a cognitive and emotional dissonance, right? The discomfort of holding two contradictory beliefs and even feelings, and to experience in that dissonance what Rabbi Soloveitchik in Halachic Man called a raging, clamorous torrent with all its crises, pangs, and torments, and what is definitional to the religious experience, I guess I humbly ask for one thing. That the vilification, the demonization, the radicalization, the broad sweeping generalizations and exaggerations about the values, concerns, or lack thereof, of those that are the opposition needs to end. In the newspapers, in the blogs, on Facebook, the narcissism of small differences that leads to such vitriolic language makes Judaism seem petty and hateful, and so close-minded on both sides. It's ridiculous. It breeds contempt, and I think it turns young people off to the entire enterprise. When a discussion about women's leadership roles or the place of LGBT Jews in our community sounds like an American presidential debate, it demeans religion. And a younger generation who is already not buying in to the significance of institutions to justify or validate their religiosity or even identity, it makes those institutions that give forth these ideas even less relevant. We have been taught, and as we said before, one of the strengths of modern Orthodoxy is that we've been taught to believe and appreciate nuance, to read carefully and to read between the lines. And we have to model as a community how to encounter differing views in a real way with understanding and with empathy, even if ultimately we fundamentally disagree with each other. I can't help but think, Beit Hillel married into Beit Shammai. We have to give the community something aspirational to believe in, even if we may end up in different places to express that belief. Next.
If you want a question, go for it.
Okay. First of all, very inspiring, and I'm learning a lot. And I hope this is okay to say here, but I'm always a participant observer. So I'm doing research as I participate in this, and this is wonderful. I wish, I can't wait to get the tape. I would add here as an Israeli that my perspective on American or North American Judaism, which I love and appreciate and often yearn for when I encounter certain bureaucracies and certain types of politicizations of religion in my own home. Nevertheless, when these kind of questions come up, it does cause me to appreciate certain aspects of the Israeli environment, which I actually think are becoming are starting to gain more traction here in interesting ways. And I'm actually going to write a book about the relationship between Israeli and American Orthodoxy. So I'm thinking a lot about these things, and that is that. For better or for worse, number one, the history of denominational Judaism that we have here didn't really evolve that way. It didn't evolve that way in Israel, and I think that sometimes that's unfair to Jews who really care and have piety but are not members of Orthodoxy, and they find themselves very disenfranchised in Israel, and that's an unfortunate thing, and I don't think that it has to be that way. Nonetheless, for most of the Israeli population, these are non-issues, non-Orthodox denominations. And Judaism is part of the street. It's much less compartmentalized. It's much less the sense that one's Jewish citizenship is reflected through one's synagogue membership, through one's activity within institutionalized Judaism. It's much more a part of the entire framework of life, and certainly for people who are committed to religious observance. And I think that what has happened sometimes there's this really interesting exchange. We'll use the issue of women and women's involvement in religious life as an example. Certainly, some of the key figures. We'll take someone like Blue Greenberg, who really started to talk and to write about increasing roles for women began in America. But the place where these things started to take on more creativity and a more dynamism is in Israel. And I think that the reason is because there's more space. There's less of the sense of rules of, well, we'll kick you out of the RCA if you do this, and we'll, there is the Rabbanut, and there are certain structures for certain things. But when it comes to spiritual life, Israel offers opportunity for a vast array of possibilities. So, for example, what is very, you see it a little bit here. I was actually at a wedding last week in Muncie that had some of those things, but the neo-Hasidism and spiritual motif, and that's sort of the second point that I want to focus on in this context, that you see emerging in Israel in certain yeshivot, places like Otniel and others. I think it's very much a reflection of the possibilities of the openness of the lack of political identity that is so much a part of the American religious but certainly Jewish establishment. And my sense, and this is from students, from traveling quite a bit throughout the world, from engaging people in Israel as well, is that for lack of a better word, for millennials, a lot of the discussion that we're having here is irrelevant. That they've had enough of these questions of, are you modern Orthodox? Are you Haredi? Are you this? Are you that? They live in multiple boxes. They move around. They're much less disturbed by the fact of whether they're tagged with something. I find that in Israel there's more, sometimes it's not a good thing, but there is more moving around, and it sometimes allows for growth of greater spirituality. And I'll add a word that I haven't heard yet here today, which is that my sense that the politicization or the denominalization, which really, as Rabbi Lichtenstein pointed out so well, facilitated the establishment, growth, and health of Jewish life and Orthodox Jewish life in America in the mid-20th century and onwards, on the other hand, sometimes stunts people's recognition that religion ultimately is about our relationship to the Almighty. And I find in my interactions with younger people, they are yearning for a sense of the divine, for a sense of the Almighty, for a sense of God, for cleaving. The reason that Hasidism and certain types of mystical approaches are becoming more popular and have gained more traction is because they see those as being alternatives to the types of strong modern ideologies that have really dominated for so long. And sometimes people use the term postmodern because it's less exacting. You know, there's no absolute truth and people are pejorative about it. But what it does mean is that people are willing to open themselves up to ways that weren't necessarily taught them as the 13 principles of the Rambam or of the, this is what you do if you're a Orthodox Jew. And sometimes, again, using Rabbi Mervis's metaphor, sometimes when you go out into the sea and you open yourself up to spiritual quests, then that can take you to certainly antinomian possibilities, a sense that the law is not what decides for me how I relate to God. It can also sometimes take me to alternatives to even Jewish or certainly Orthodox ways. Nonetheless, if we talk about growing in one's connection to God, number one, and if we talk about that for Judaism to have vitality, it needs to be something which is moving, which is dynamic, which is not stagnant, then I think that these are issues that our young generation senses instinctively, and certainly educators, rabbis, and people who are looking at issues of continuity, it's very important to be sensitive to these things, and not only sensitive, but to recognize and to try to look for the positive in them rather than saying, oh, that's not Orthodox, or that's not the way we were taught, and therefore that's not Judaism, or ha-ha, they're doing Karlbach, that's so cute, but that's not real. These people really, these kids and people, and a lot of them really looking to develop a relationship to God, which ultimately is what religion is about.
Let's go right with that and try and further that idea. I want to ask both of you about young people. And thinking about what Dr. Furtzger is talking about, if there is a search for spirituality, which is really going on around the world, all young people, it takes traditional and non-traditional forms. So let's think about this in a Jewish context. Specifically, you know, Rabbi Lichtenstein, you were talking about the growth of the day school, which has had a certain model for quite a long time. But now Dr. Furtzger is pointing out that millennials and post-millennials are engaged in a kind of a new kind of new old kind of search for God and search for the authentic, which is a word that comes up a lot in modernity, authenticity. So I want each of you to comment on what kinds of things we might implement in current Jewish education that would be sort of the indispensable features of a 21st century Jewish education, given these kinds of desires on the part of young people. Let's start with you, Rabbi Lichtenstein, and move across.
You know, I'm a traditionalist, and I think I'm pretty open. Some of my best friends are Asher Lopatin, Rabbi Asher Lopatin, and Rabbi Avi Weiss. And it pains me that people like that are marginalized in the Orthodox community. Pains me greatly. They haven't been kicked out of the Rabbinical Council of America yet, but I'm not sure I can give you an answer to spirituality and everything else, but I do know that there's a power struggle going on in the Orthodox world. Big power struggle in Israel. I met up with it this past summer with a convert. It was just a power struggle. I'll talk about it a little bit tomorrow in my presentation, but this was a convert whose major question to me was, when I get married and I have a baby and I'm holding the baby in my hospital bed, am I allowed to pass the baby to my husband? She was asking the question about a rather far out harchaka in Hilchos Nida, a very fringe kind of question. And I reassured her, and I was sitting with her future husband at the time too, that that's fine. I don't want to go into the details as to why it's fine, but that's the woman that the Supreme Rabbinical Court in Yerushalayim ignored letters from the two chief rabbis who confirmed my conversion authority and made her convert again. It was very simply a power struggle. And the same power struggle is going on in America. Talk about young people being fed up with it. It isn't just young people. It's almost all thinking people are absolutely fed up with it. Why isn't Yeshiva Chovevei Torah kosher to produce graduates who can join the Rabbinical Council of America? That's absurd. This is an Orthodox institution. We have to clean house, and I'm pretty committed to trying to do that in the wake of the conversion crisis, because as I'll explain tomorrow, there's a conversion crisis going on right here in North America as well. This power struggle has to stop. And we do have to be ready to accept a much larger tent than some of my colleagues in the Rabbinical Council of America are prepared to accept. Rabbi Lopatin is absolutely right. So is Rabbi Weiss. On the other hand, if people want to expand the role of women in Orthodoxy beyond great teachers in day schools, next to whom I'm sitting in one case, but also to do it in shuls where it's coming. It's coming down the line. There's no question it's going to come. And we have to look at it as an opportunity and not as a threat. But too many of us are looking at it as a threat. On the other hand, not every shul is ready yet to embrace, I probably shouldn't use that word, embrace, to accept a woman rabbi. And you can't force things on synagogues that are not ready to do it. So ways have to be found how to bring women into pastoral roles and teaching roles and clergy roles, maybe without calling them rabbis or maharats or rabbats or whatever it is, just to get it in there. Rabbi Benny Lau has pioneered it in Yerushalayim, and he's coming to our shul in New York in 2 weeks, and I'm sure he's going to talk about it, and I want him to talk about it. And he's got a wonderful young woman who is essentially a rabbanit in Yerushalayim. Does that make her husband a rav? I don't know. But she's functioning there. Now, he had to sort of fight for it because not everybody in his synagogue was ready. I don't think this is something you should force on anybody, but ways have to be found how to enable the highly educated women, educated in halacha, in all of Jewish learning, to assume responsibilities that will enhance the opportunities of members of modern Orthodox synagogues. I didn't get to the kids.
Okay, we'll get back.
But we'll get back to it.
So as far as educating modern Orthodox youth today, I think that it is vital that every yeshiva high school have a Machshevet Yisrael program where students are given the space to engage in issues of faith directly, head on, where they're studying classical Jewish texts and classical Jewish thinkers. At the same time, they're being given the space to develop their own nuanced opinions, but where they can see that they're engaged in a process of an emotionally and intellectually very rich and satisfying Jewish philosophical tradition and theological tradition that has taken on belief head on. I think this can be done both in a classroom setting, through journaling. We have to be creative in the techniques that we use that allow students to openly engage these issues in a way where they feel like they're entering a space that is judgment-free so that they can really ask these kinds of questions. That's first. Second, I think we need to make sure that we are also addressing issues that are relevant to kids today. And that is everything from, because Judaism needs to feel relevant. We want them to develop their spiritual selves and feel like Judaism has something to say to them about the issues that they do care about. So I see this around sex and physical intimacy, ethics on the internet, entitlement and privilege. These are issues that we need to actually be taking up in our basic educations. And I think also, it can't just be done by the schools. I think a lot of responsibility is often put on educational institutions to model this, to teach it. But if it's not being reinforced at home, if the parents and grandparents and aunts and uncles are not working on developing a spiritual self, kids don't have models for what that could look like. So schools and families need to join together in this endeavor. And I'm not sure this is as true in a Canadian context, but what makes it difficult in the American context is that we put a lot of pressure on our students. I mentioned this before, because of the priority we place on making a good salary. From the time kids are in ninth grade, and this is a true story, a ninth grade parent called in when their child got a B in biology because how are they going to get into medical school? And the students have passions, but they don't have time to develop them, whether that be in terms of social justice or in terms of developing their religious personalities. We don't give them the time or space to do that because they are so pressured to be engaged in SAT studying, and then even once you get into college, there's the GREs, and it seems to never end. So we need to shift the values in our community to make way for the ability for students to engage in and to teach them the value that we as a community value, developing a spiritual self.
I just want to follow up with you for a second there. Let's say they do go to a Machshevet Yisrael class. I'm not sure that that's going to actually address the sort of yearning that Dr. Furtziger is talking about. I mean, I've taught Machshevet Yisrael for many years, and I've trained teachers who teach Machshevet Yisrael, and even at its best, I'm wondering if it's going to address issues of certain kind of spirituality and authenticity, because much of the curriculum in Machshavat Yisrael is actually referring back to pre-modern thinkers, thinkers who may not, you know, be directly in tune with the kinds of world that they face. I'm wondering if we would do more radical things in schools, teach meditation, for instance, teach a different way of thinking about prayer, teach alternate visions of God, contemporary religion, whatever it might be. How far could we actually expand these things?
So I should mention that I think it's also crucial for schools to have an experiential component to Judaism. That is not just a Shabbaton is not just a nice thing you do once a year. It's actually something that can be transformative. And we have to be just as conscious of how we set up our classrooms to how we set up a circle around a tish. Because that is where a lot of students are connecting, where they're beginning to feel something. And I'll say that in the Machshavat Yisrael class that I teach, we're really working with students to develop an intuitive sense, to be comfortable with what Professor Shalom Carmi calls the cognitive counsel of their emotions, to develop that, to work on that, and then to give them outlets to actually put that into practice. So I think meditation is true. SAR offered actually a variety of different tefillah options, including a meditation option, which was built into getting through the basic requirements of a halachic tefillah, but then giving students this space. There was a space to go out into nature. They would go on a walk before tefillah. For other kids, it's actually learning a Mishnah or something in Talmud Torah that actually could inspire them to then feel a connection. So providing a variety of different experiences, I think, for kids is key today as well.
Yeah. I mean, I love the idea of going out for a walk for tefillah. Unfortunately, in Toronto, that would be hypothermia for 6 months of the year. So, you know, it's more of an Israeli thing, I think. Yeah. So.
I just wanted to pick up on something that Rabbi Lookstein said, something I've been thinking about for a while. I think we all tend to think about what was inspirational for us when we were at a formative stage in our own lives and what caused us sometimes just purely liking the lifestyle we grew up in, but if we felt inspired, and I certainly did feel inspired in my late teens, what were those things that gave me that fire? What were those things that made me want to dedicate myself to Jewish life in a variety of ways? And sometimes the cumulative also, like you enjoyed them or they excited you, but you didn't really you didn't internalize them in the sense of taking them the next step, but they sort of added on. So I was looking at Rabbi Lookstein as he was speaking about feminism. And many of you may know that Rabbi Lookstein was one of the leading figures in the Soviet Jewry movement. I can tell you that for me, growing up in the 1970s, Soviet Jewry was part of being an Orthodox Jew. It wasn't just part, it was part of being a certain type of Orthodox Jew who was in solidarity not only with Jews in the Soviet Union, but also with non-Orthodox Jews, because we were all in a partnership in order to achieve something that we considered to be a Jewish goal, a Torah goal, a crucial moment, especially in light of our being a post-Holocaust generation. But it gave tremendous energy to what it meant to be a Jew. I mean, I actually attended SAR Elementary School. We were two blocks away from the Soviet mission. So Avi Weiss would come by and say, "Rabbi Fold, we need the eighth graders for a rally. You know, something happened," and we just, you know, cancel class and we'd go over to the Soviet mission. But in truth, and I remember when we met. You know, I was already in Yeshiva University. When we greeted Natan Sharansky the first time he came to America, and what a sense of being a part of something. And the reason I'm mentioning it is maybe to remind some people. My son got married a month ago, and a rabbi that I'm very close with in Israel told me, Rav Yair Dreyfus, he from Siach, he told me that whenever he performs a wedding, he, in addition to talking to the couple, he always says to the people in the audience, he says, you know, coming to a wedding is an opportunity for all of us to go back to that our own weddings and to think of that moment and how special that was for us and to use it as a vehicle for sort of inspiring us as within our our married life. But I think the same thing in terms of when we look back, you know, when I look back to the Soviet Jewry movement, it was like a wedding. You know, it was like this thing that really gave energy. And I think a lot, and I don't want to be critical, and I do take what Rabbi Strachler said before. I think so far I see a very positive trope in the discussion here, and less of a sort of, you know, we're all in crisis. But I to look positively, when I look at feminism, I don't look at it only in terms of the controversies, and they are clearly there, and there is clearly a lot of dissension on that issue. But what I do see is if I look in the Orthodox world, certainly in the modern Orthodox world, where there is passion and where there is energy, certainly in the American modern Orthodox world, it's in feminism. It's in women's learning. It's in looking for ways, for paths and for portals of spiritual development and entry in Israel as well. Who are the people who get excited about learning Gemara today? It's the girls. Honestly, and it's just the fact. It's just what you see. So I think number one, when we look at the issues and the controversies or discussions about role of women in Judaism, we have to be able to recognize that one of the things that this brings is passion, and religion is about passion. So the Soviet Jewry movement gave me passion. For some of us, Israel was passion. Some of us, it still is. For a lot of people, it's a little bit past for a variety of reasons. But this is a place where there's passion. Now, number one, that's important to appreciate whether one agrees with all the proposed changes or not, to appreciate what it is bringing, the energies that is bringing. Number two, it should, I think, be a cause for people who maybe don't identify, or in addition, to think, are there other issues today? What brings us passion? So I mentioned for some of the young people, maybe God, maybe a sense of the spiritual is something that can nurture passion. Are there other issues, movements, ideals as Jews that really could get us excited, could get us to go on a bus for 10 hours to Washington? I'm sure a lot of people in this room did, for a rally with 250,000 other Jews to, you know, in 1987, or to stand in Dagak Hammarskjöld Plaza, or to be one of those people who traveled in these clandestine missions to bring tefillin and sidurim and stuff to refuseniks, all these things. I think for a lot of people in this room, that was a very, very inspiring piece of what gave us a reason to be excited about being Jewish. And I hope that the thinkers, or there are thinkers and leaders among us who are going to come up with those things and are going to facilitate that for the generations moving forward.
I would like to just react briefly to this. I don't think they're ready for questions yet or participation. I'm assuming there will be a time for it.
It's okay.
Because she's really waiting. She very, very anxious to...
You just said exactly what I've been waiting to say. The topic here was, what has the history of modern Orthodoxy? This is really what you've done wonderfully. You talked about Mikveh, 1945. That is when women started to study, and that is what you have done, and I want to thank you for being on the panel, because you have done, you know.
Thank you very much. I'm going to take questions and comments right afterwards. Thank you. Yeah, we will.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I want to react to Adam Furziger's comment. I don't have very much to add on it. I know from dozens and dozens of Ramaz alumni that their passion for Judaism was deeply affected by our involvement in the Soviet Jewry movement. I used to drive some of the teachers in the school crazy when I said to them that you can get more done educationally in 2 hours at a demonstration than you can in 10 hours of class teaching. And my slogan, and everybody in the school knows it, is never let school get in the way of your education. We stopped school for any real cause. It was Israel, very often. Everybody knew if you wanted a demonstration, the first place to go to was Ramaz, and we always said yes. There was no such thing as, well, it's not convenient now. No, we always stopped and we went. And Soviet Jewry was a major part of it. So was Israel, 1967, when we went to Washington. And other times when we stood for, I forget the name of the soldier who was 5 years.
Gilad
Shalit, right. And you know what the kids did? They talked during the demonstrations. I used to go nuts. Why aren't you listening to the speeches? No, they met their friends from camp because there were other schools there. You know what? Didn't make any difference. They knew that we were canceling school in order to assemble for something very important. The trouble is we don't have any big issue now. God forbid we should have a really big issue. I don't know what the next issue is going to be. You can't just create it out of nothing. So, you're trying to think of things. I don't have any more
right,
ideas.
So I mean, I think that's really, the last point is the point, right? I'll tell you a story that reminds me of what both of you are saying. So I was invited several times to speak in the UK at the Limud conference in December. And the last time I was there, Natan Sharansky was also there. And he was giving he was doing a dialogue with Yosef Mendelevich. So I thought, this is fantastic. I'm going to go. And I felt like, I better go early so I can get a seat. So I go early, and they've got him in the big hall because the expectation is everybody's going to come. And the place was 60% empty. We in our generation take very much for granted that our cultural landmarks, our heroes, the ethos we grew up with, whether it was 67 or Entebbe or Soviet Jewry, is kind of just mouvan may love for everybody. And the answer is that it's certainly not. I heard young people who bothered to come leaving the hall, meeting their friends, and their friends said, oh, well, where were you? And he said, oh, yeah, I went to see this guy like Natan Sharansky. Oh, who's he? And that was quite pervasive. I think we always take for granted that what we were passionate about, others are going to be passionate about, and it's actually profoundly untrue. So my question to all of you, which you sort of introduced, is, so what's the passion now, right? You were talking about search for God, but you were also talking about social orthodoxy, and that leads to a question, right? Social orthodoxy, if you don't know, has been coined. There was a well-known commentary essay in 2014, which Jay Lefkowitz wrote a piece called The Rise of Social Orthodoxy, in which he stated explicitly a disconnect between many Orthodox Jews and any form of a powerful belief system. In other words, we're socially Orthodox. We come to shul, we like to daven, we like kiddush, we like to meet our friends. We don't really believe in God. We don't really care about theology. We're not really interested in a mission beyond continuity. And he writes, I imagine that for many others like me, the key to Jewish living is not our beliefs, but our commitment to a set of practices and values that foster community and continuity. Do you see this, Professor Furtziger, as a good thing, as a heroic thing, or a bad thing, a bad omen for the future with a sort of diluted religious passion?
I thought it was an astute article. I think that Jay's a very smart guy. I think that he was a little bit too prideful about it. I don't think that it's an ideal, but I think that part of what was mistaken about the article is that he thinks there's only social modern orthodoxy. I think there's a lot of social Haredi orthodoxy. I think that the social aspect of religion is a reality. So many people just do what they're used to. How many people send their kids to day schools and to camps? Because they assume if that's going to be their friends, then they're going to want to stick with it. And that's just the way that things go. So I think that maybe he took, you know, he says that my father didn't believe in God, I don't believe in God, you know, he tried to dramatize it. But I think that it's really something that is very much a part of organized religion. What I was thinking as you were speaking is that it could be, I'm not sure about this, I'm starting to think about it, so I'm just going to share this, is that like a more traditionalist, what might be called Haredi orthodoxy, can thrive more easily without having passion issues than a modern orthodoxy. That because modern orthodoxy is by definition so intertwined or so involved with broader societal issues, if it doesn't have things that drive it and that make it feel, you know, it could be, you know, Rabbi Lichtenstein was talking about the day school movement, all this. My understanding of the history of modern orthodoxy in America is that the idea, the very idea that you could be orthodox and be American for your father's generation, certainly, and I think for my parents growing up, and you know, that in itself was sort of like an ideology. It was sort of like, you know, when Yeshiva University was took the idea of Torah Umada, and if you look at Bernard Revel's speeches when he established Yeshiva College, you know, this idea that you could be really American and really committed to Judaism was something which was really was a passionate something that could give a certain fervor to it, and also people were really excited about being Americans, Canadians, being accepted into society. But moving forward, once we have such an established, successful, materially, and I think what you said about the issues of materialism and the limited scope, especially, and this is not the case in Israel, because of tuitions, because the expense of being a modern Orthodox Jew is so high, then it tends to encourage people to go into certain, you know, finance professions, etc., where one can earn enough money to send your kids to camp, school, go on vacations, live in a neighborhood which is usually more expensive, etc. And that's unfortunate because it what it does is it limits the sort of intellectual breadth and the sort of exposures of our people, and therefore the conversations become very narrow and don't have that. I think that was a wonderful point. But here, in terms of social orthodoxy, yes, I think modern orthodoxy has to be very self-conscious. Not that there isn't social orthodoxy, but that there is at least an elite, and I used to be against elites. I think everyone has to be the same. I don't believe that anymore. I'm a strong believer that we have to cultivate elites. There has to be a core group of people who are passionate, who really care, who are dedicated, and they can't just be rabbis. They have to be lay people. They have to be lay leaders. But there is tremendous value, in my opinion, to investing money, creating institutions that will cultivate elites, because elites will be the ones who will define the ideology or the core ideals of the movement. There will always be socially orthodox or socially driven people, but if there's a passionate elite, an excited group of people that are spread among communities, I think that they can define the ambience of the religion.
Sure. Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly with that last point, because I think when I read that article, I thought, well, as an educator, how would we transmit social orthodoxy? We can posture it as an identity that's a very real identity in the modern Orthodox world, and we don't necessarily need to have a sense of, you know, fatalism about it. But I thought, should we create a curricula around what it would look like to be a socially Orthodox Jew? What I guess was disheartening about that thought was, what would aspiration look like in that form of Judaism? So that's why I was a little bit hesitant about social orthodoxy from an educational perspective. But in thinking about religious passion, I also wonder today, you know, with the Soviet Jewry movement, there was an agreed upon goal. And today there's a lot of skepticism about groupthink. We place such a high premium on individuality, on not just going along with the group, with I've got to be nuanced, I can't wholeheartedly buy into whatever I'm hearing. And I wonder if, yes, there's passion, I think, certainly around feminism and those kinds of issues, but it's not a group passion. It's different individuals with their voices, each one looking for what new thing they can contribute to the conversation. And that's something that looks different about the passion, I think, of today because of the emphasis we've placed on especially students and this next generation developing an individual character. So in thinking about what are the issues that are going to drive us, that are going to make us passionate, we also have to consider that we're educating them on some level not to just buy into group thinking. And of course, that's manifested in their practice and commitment to halakha as well. So that's just something to be conscious of as moving forward.
Can I join in on the social orthodoxy? I happen to be very, very close to Jay Lefkowitz, who wrote that article. He's a very wonderful young friend of mine. I knew him before he was born. I was at his parents' wedding. His father, Jerry Lefkowitz, was my tennis opponent for about 60 years. We've played approximately 500 sets of tennis over those years, and the score is 251 to 249, and he has more than I have. So I really know them very well. Jay Lefkowitz is one of the most active members of my synagogue and the Ramaz board. He's a key person in the community. I don't fully agree with his social orthodox position, but I can tell you that there are people like Jay Lefkowitz who love Judaism, who love the Jewish people, who are passionate about serving the Jewish community. And he's one of them, but there are others. A lot of them went to Camp Masad back when, and develop that passion there. My problem with social orthodoxy is if in the end, if you don't really believe in God, A, when push comes to shove, how are you going to keep halakha when it's difficult? Because there are times when it's difficult. What's the authority behind you? Say, well, I believe in the Jewish people, therefore I'm going to not take a test in my school on Shabbos, because even though it's going to be very painful for me, because I believe in the Jewish people. I don't know if that's strong enough. I also don't know if you can, you're talking about your curriculum. I think the problem in social orthodoxy is I'm afraid that a lot of the social orthodox, their children will not survive, this won't survive into a second generation or a third generation. These, even though, to be fair, Jay's father was socially orthodox too. I used to sit in my living room with him when we were both 21 years of age on a Shabbos, and he's talking to me about the fact that he doesn't really believe in God, but he thinks you have to keep mitzvos because that's very important in terms of Jewish continuity and the Jewish community. And I said to him, Jerry, if I didn't believe in God, I would go into my bedroom and get my pack of cigarettes and come out and smoke a cigarette. The reason I don't smoke a cigarette on Shabbos is because I believe in God. I'm not sure I'm right and that he's wrong. I just worry about how you transmit this to the next generation. But it's real. Social orthodoxy is really real for a lot of people today.
I'm going to throw one more out, and then we're going to open up to questions from the floor. You know, orthodoxy is a label, right? It's a label that was constructed in the 19th century. It was a polemic that kind of emerged out of the reform movement, and in a sense, I'm wondering if it's lost its usefulness as an adjective. Is it still relevant? Does it just occupy a kind of niche position in modern Jewish culture? I guess what I'm asking you is what should be the position of orthodoxy to the world? Like, how does it see itself in relationship not just to other factions in modern orthodoxy or factions in Judaism, but what does it have to bring to the world at large?
I just want to say a word about that. My father, Olav HaShalom, was always against the title Orthodox. He said exactly what you said. That's a title that was given to us by others who were not Orthodox. And Orthodox means right opinion. He preferred the term, which he never really used, orthoprax, that you have to live the right way. I would say I am a practical pluralist, not a theoretical pluralist. I don't believe, I believe what Rabbi Strachler said before. I believe that modern orthodoxy is the right way to be a Jew. I understand that not everybody's going to do it my way, both to the right and to the left, and I think we have to be together with all of the Jewish people. That's my practical pluralism. But theoretically, I'm not a pluralist. And if I were to look for a term or a defining term for us, I would say our approach to Judaism, is halachic Judaism. Now, how does that separate me from the Haredim? It doesn't. But that's where I part company with my colleagues and friends in the conservative and reform movement, because they're not committed to halacha. We are committed to halacha. That's where the line is drawn. My father liked traditional Judaism, and Jack Wertheimer has written about how in the mid-20th century, Orthodox leaders who were concerned about being cloistered spoke about traditional Judaism rather than Orthodox. He was talking about my father. I don't know what the title is, but I think we have to present ourselves to ourselves and to the world as halachic Jews who are open to Western civilization.
At the end of the day, I think what's going to allow modern orthodoxy to survive and remain relevant is if we live our values, to stop worrying so much about boundaries and borders and lines and titles, and if we're really committed and passionate about what we do, keeping halacha, being a force in the greater world as a community that has an unbelievable organizational structure, and because of that has the power to do great things out there in the world, and to keep ourselves internally motivated and strong, as long as we keep that up and just live our values, we'll continue to thrive as I think we are right now.
I think orthodoxy is purely a utilitarian term. If it helps people to grow as Ovdei Hashem, as worshipers, as believers, as people who live according to certain values, then it's good. If it's not, then it has no use whatsoever. Here, I've never met Rabbi Strachler, but I've heard great things about him, and hearing him speak only confirmed those things. Nonetheless, I totally did not identify with the idea that I want to claim that the shul the Rambam would attend is my shul, besides the fact that he was Sephardic. But I think it's, forgive me, I'm in your bait, but it's just ahistorical. I don't think the Rambam would feel comfortable in any shul that existed today. I think that Judaism has certain core ideals, but it's an evolving religion. The world is evolving. And I think that religion and the way that we worship God within certain continuities has to be evolving, and that what we have to be asking ourselves is not, if you know the midrash about Moshe Rabbeinu going into Rabbi Akiva's Beit Midrash to me is a very important one, and him feeling uncomfortable and then hearing something and say, oh, there is some little connection. There are many different ways of interpreting that midrash, but to me, we're not in Eastern Europe, and if I do have criticism of some rhetoric within the Haredi world, it is the idealization of as if Eastern Europe was this ideal Jewish life. It wasn't, but it's nice to use it as a paradigm in certain situations. I think that what it sometimes does when we look back to those people is that we shirk our responsibility to be creative and to be trying to cultivate something which is moving, which has energy to it. So I would hope that we are founded, or that we are grounded in the Rambam and in the Talmud, in the theology of the Tanakh, but that we have certain commitments in terms of halakha as a legal binding system, which is the part of Judaism throughout the history, as we can at least define it, or as we can take that leap of faith, but that we don't look to what was the past as being the definition for who we are, but rather how we can make this viable as we move forward.
I'm happy to take questions from the floor. Step up to the mic. Please don't give a speech, just ask a question. Thank you.
Maybe a 15-second introduction to the final question. You've talked about lay leadership. My notes have gone. You've talked about lay leadership being required and developed, and what you failed to mention or perhaps appreciate is that Jewish lay leadership now is money-based. It's not faith-based. It's not enthusiasm-based. It's certainly not intellectually based. And I've seen a great many Jewish volunteers smacked down over the years when they came very enthusiastically to do good for the Jewish community, and they simply weren't rich. And now we have leadership not representing...
Question. Question. That was 15 seconds.
Okay, 15 seconds. How do we get away from those Jewish leaders who do not represent what the rank and file think and serve sometimes simply to enrich themselves in certain matters? How do we develop that leadership?
Well, you put your finger on something of a problem. I'm sort of thinking, you know, in terms of my own experience over the years, I don't know if I would say that certainly in Ramaz, I don't know that I would say that the leadership was wealth-based. I think it was more intellectually based and more commitment based. Right now, the chairman of the board of the school is by no means one of the wealthiest people in our community. He's a graduate of the school whose three children are also graduates. But that's just my experience. I'm not saying it's not a problem. I think in the Jewish world in general, it is a problem. I also don't think necessarily that wealthy people can't be leaders. I wouldn't denigrate them automatically.
I actually don't really recognize, in large part, the picture you're offering. I mean, I can speak about being involved in this shul for many years. Having been involved with many presidents here and lay leaders, you know, these people, they don't have to do what they do. They volunteer and, generally speaking, speak to any president of a shul, and what they'll tell you after their two-year stint is it was way, way, way more work than I ever expected. Way more meetings, way more time, way more. I'm not here to get into a dispute with you. I'm just here to tell you that you can't tar everybody.
I can look at the Jewish Leadership Council in the UK. I can look at UJA here.
Right. Well, that's not the only thing of what we call lay leadership. There are a lot of people working in a lot of different situations in lay leadership. They volunteer. They don't get paid. They put in a lot of hours, a lot of energy, and they just do it because they want to help. So I think it's important to finesse, to nuance that a bit. Next question.
in addition to all of the challenges with content, and there's a lot, I wonder whether, in fact, we also have major challenges with the formats. The fact that kids are getting information. We don't have the old method of a control access. It's open. Every kid, every teenager has ready access to blogs, to all kinds of information out there that shape and mold and question their opinions. And are we prepared, or do we have the tools to engage in a very different way that we can't only control? And as well, as parents, do we have the literacy to handle these kinds of questions, to help guide them towards finding those answers?
So I think that one of the major challenges in education today is to teach our kids critical thinking skills. We need to teach them how not to just imbibe culture, but to sift carefully through it, because we don't want them just taking in everything whole. And I think it is difficult, even I'm at the kind of end of a generation that didn't grow up with the internet, and even I struggle with sometimes seeing how my students use it and utilize it. We need to teach skills, because content is out there like never before. They have access to absolutely everything. So we need to teach them how to be critical consumers. That's really, I think, what education needs to be about today, and parents and schools need to cooperate in figuring out how to teach that, how to use Jewish values and Judaism as a filter for making sense of what we should be taking in and what we need to filter out, because it's here to stay. And kind of this, let's just throw up our hands and fully accept it or say none of it, doesn't work. And maybe there's something we can learn from the Haredi and more right-wing communities and how they're handling this. We might make fun of putting filters on the internet in our home and on kids' phones and checking them, but what's out there today is frightening, and we need to be aware of it. And yeah, I think that's going to be our challenge.
I happen to think that technology is something that you can't control. I think Ralph Cook said the same thing years ago. There's certain things that are busted out like a tiger, and they're just going to run, and the question is, how do you run with them somewhat? The other thing is, as a university professor, I think it's important to recognize there are reasons to go to university because you need that degree. There are reasons to go to university because people learn well in a classroom context. Other people, though, learn well on the internet, and it's fine. But there's another reason to go to university is if you have exposure to people who do the things that Shirley's talking about, people who are critical thinkers. And to me, if there is any justification for universities to continue to play the role that they do, research universities in our society, it's because they have to be bastions of critical thinking. And like you said, because we are overwhelmed by information, if we don't have tools for sinun, for sorting out what we encounter, then we become sort of chaotic in the way that we conduct ourselves.
Two more, Max.
My question is about the other denomination. So given the centrality of Israel in the Jewish world, do you see a role for modern orthodoxy to support the fight of reform and conservative to become a legitimate force in Israel?
Yeah, so I feel that there were times certainly when Orthodoxy didn't think it could survive. That sometimes, let's say, Rabbi Lukstein mentioned the Mechitza debate, and sometimes when you read the rhetoric there, it's kind of shocking. Nonetheless, I guess that was a survivalist tactic. I think that survivalism, certainly in Israel in terms of Orthodoxy, should not be the posture. Even in North America, to a certain degree, certainly if you take the Pew report seriously, I think on those levels we're in pretty good ground. And thinking beyond the Orthodox enclave and ways to facilitate Jews throughout the spectrum enable them to engage in Judaism. And Israel still is a big one. Although campus life and BDS and all these things and are really chipping away at young people's sense, certainly non-Orthodox young people's sense of connection to Israel, I think that in Israeli society, one of the things that we're missing is a little competition. I think that there would, if there's a little bit of religious competition, it would actually it would bring up some good things. And I have a doctoral student who just wrote a wonderful PhD about non-Orthodox Judaism in Tel Aviv, and it was fascinating to me to see how the Beit Daniel Reform shul is competing with Chabad and is competing with the Tzioni, Dati Tzioni Kolel, and all these people for municipal funds, for people to attend their Giyur, for all these things. And it, at least in that little area of North Tel Aviv, it seemed to me that it was a very healthy thing. And I'm not sure how modern Orthodox specifically campaign, but I certainly don't think that denying access to Israel and to holy places to people who are feel very close to the Kotel but are not affiliated with the Orthodox movement is something is a good thing. There should be certainly, you know, Natan Sharansky, I was in a session with him a month and a half ago where he described how he negotiated all the different constituencies, and he came up with this nice compromise, and then at the last second, the whole thing fell apart, and it just seems so tragic because he's a person who really, as the head of the Jewish Agency, tries to take a broader look, but he also is very connected to the Orthodox community, and it seemed so unfortunate that at the last second, this compromise that he was able to produce fell apart, because I think that is the way that things need to go.
Last question.
In listening to the speakers tonight, I couldn't help but notice how much easier it was for me and my generation to grow up modern Orthodox than it is now for my kids and their generation. So in my day, there's sometimes a practical conflict between Orthodoxy and modernity, such as an exam scheduled on Yom Tov, but there was rarely an ideological conflict. You could be excited about freeing Soviet Jews because the Soviets were the bad guys, right? You could be excited about Israel, especially around the time of the 67 war, because the whole world loved Israel and thought they were heroes. Today, we know how the modern world looks at Israel, and we know how the modern world looks at religion. You know, if you're religious, you're fundamentalist, you're backward, you're against LGBTQ, et cetera, et cetera. Like, how do we help our kids?
Great question. We got to work harder. You have to work harder. And I think we've been talking about that basically all night, but we don't have real solutions. We have to meet the kids where they are, and we have to, as Shuli said, we've got to be open enough to allow them to ask all their questions and raise all of their issues. I'm the sex education teacher at Ramaz. They call it sex with the rabbi. Not really allowed to say that anymore because it's not a good thing. But I teach the sophomore classes, each class about a quarter of the year. I have to tell you that my views have changed very significantly over the course of the last 20, 30 years that I've been teaching the course. Homosexual behavior is a significant piece of the course at the beginning, and if I were to compare what I used to say to them 25 years ago and what I'm saying to them today, it's very, very different. We have to be aware of how they're thinking. We have to be aware of what the world is thinking. And then we have to be aware of what the halakha is and somehow enable them to understand that, I'm just giving one example, the halakha is the halakha, and we have to be tolerant and open to people who don't necessarily keep the halakha. Another major issue is sexual promiscuity and how to explain to kids that sex is not just about fun, it's about relationship. That's the biggest thing that I try to teach them. Hopefully they learn it, but they learn it only from discussion and back and forth. And I think that's what we have to do on every area of our Jewish education.
I think we also need to admit to our kids that we ourselves struggle with these issues, that we don't have all the answers, but that's the beauty of being a religious person. It's a lifelong journey, and there is no the answer for most of the really important stuff. And as we grow and develop and experience life in all different ways, our values, our opinions change. We're fluid people. That's first. I think we also need to model what nuanced thinking looks like, not presenting everything as black and white all the time, that there are areas of gray, and that's what religion is about, is struggling with, and it's, you're a part of that beautiful process that makes it so inspiring to be a religious person today, and we need to make our homes places of open discussion and open debate, where families are sitting around the Shabbat table and every opinion is allowed, so that we can help each other come to places emotionally, intellectually, where we're not stagnant, but we're satisfied to at least go on another day.
Yeah, I'm just going to add one thing to that. I think you, in many ways, need a revolution, not just in Jewish education, but in Jewish teacher education. I always tell the teachers I supervise that teachers teach to what the level often of what they were taught. And for to be a really good teacher, you have to actually transcend what you were taught. You have to go far beyond what you were taught. You have to keep your passion and curiosity about what's going on in all areas of life and all areas of the intellectual world going. And I don't think we have that. I think that we sort of do it in very segmented, you know, you teach Tanakh and you teach Machshavah Yisrael and you teach Gemara, but I think it's actually impossible in the contemporary world to teach these subjects without, in a sense, creating Renaissance people who can connect all of these aspects to a lot of other foci in the world. And until you get that, you know, kids can have questions and have yearnings, but if they come into a educational situation, both at home and school and shul, and the answers they get are basically from people who have not kept growing, there's going to be a limitation on that discourse. That's the first thing. The last thing I would say is that much of what we do Jewishly is not about what we say. It's about what we're modeling, because the truth is that it doesn't really matter if you pump home a lot of information. That can all get blown up as soon as they see a lack of integrity in the community, a lack of sacredness. If they walk into a shul and they really sniff out in 5 seconds that this is just sheer hypocrisy because everybody's talking. So that's where it's at. I mean, those are the hard facts. We don't like to, you know, we're kind of in denial about them. And until we get out of denial, get out of the cave, recognize that modernity, and I agree, is here to stay in very profound ways, then we're going to keep bemoaning things that we actually have the power to do something about. And we can change it, we can change our world, and we can change the world, and we just have to believe in it. Thanks very much for coming out.